Are you ready? Are you ready to take massive action towards building a life and lifestyle that rewards you with a fit body, endless supplies of mental and physical energy, and total freedom from guilt around food and exercise? This is Cut the Fat Podcast. Hey, everybody, it's Dr. Ray Hines, joined here with Blythe Wagner. Hey, Blythe.
Hey, Ray, how are you?
Awesome. And how about yourself?
Absolutely wonderful. Thank you for asking. Looking forward to providing another podcast for our listeners.
So, it's like a new baby that we don't have a name for, right? So we want to kind of get a little experience with it and see what name kind of fits, try a few things on. So this podcast episode is really about eating, right? But it doesn't have a topic name yet. By the time that we publish it, I will have figured something out. But for now, it's just about how to eat, about principles of eating and things that we can draw from various diets, right?
Absolutely, yes. And we're going to start with an article that CNN published under the health section, if anybody wants to go in there and read it. It's about the Mediterranean diet and how they have listed it as the best overall diet for the year 2019. And I thought there were a bunch of great golden nuggets in here. They analyzed 41 different eating plans, and the Mediterranean diet floated to the top as the best overall diet. And we're going to kind of delve into that a little bit and talk about why that works for people, why other diets work for people, and some of the other things that are out there that have, some good pieces to them, but also some things that you may just want to throw away and move on.
Right. So, they get into, and the reason this kind of caught our eye for this purpose was because they got into the diets that they rank as best for weight loss, right? And there were three that kind of came to the top for this CNN article. I think two of them I'm on board with. The third one, you can imagine that I'm not so much on board with. Although, just like with every diet, we have the ability to pull some golden nuggets from each one of these diets that have been listed in this article. So why don't we just jump in and why don't we talk about we'll get a little bit into the Mediterranean diet. I actually want to spend some time talking about the Japanese diet and cultural lifestyle as well, and how we can draw from the wisdom of how Japanese cultures eat and live as well.
Yeah, and that's something that we're going to be talking about today, cultural eating, because, a lot of us have grown up in the U.S. A lot of us have grown up in different countries. Depending on where you are living and where you have grown up, you probably are just comfortable with your culture's way of eating. And let's just start with the article. So the Mediterranean diet was labeled the number one overall. So for everyone everywhere is what they're talking about. But it was rated 12th when it comes to weight loss, which I thought was interesting. So the top three weight loss diets that they selected were Weight Watchers was number one, Volumetrics, which is number two, and the Flexitarian diet, which is kind of a newer one out there, as number three. Should we kind of go in and talk about what each of those?
Right. So, the Weight Watchers being number one is the one I have the biggest problem with. And the reason isn't because it's not effective for people. Weight Watchers can be an effective way to lose weight. The problem for me is that they are not great at helping people to keep it off. And the reason is, when I'm coaching somebody, my ultimate goal is to try to coach myself out of the job. And with Weight Watchers, they never want to coach themselves out of the job. They want to keep you coming back and back because that's how they make their money. So their approach, their system to me, and there may be listeners out there who disagree, who have been and still go through Weight Watchers. Some people, I think, are lifetime members of Weight Watchers. But my experience with that is that it doesn't truly give you the tools and, most importantly, the self-confidence to go out into the world on your own and find that you don't necessarily need them to move forward, right?
I'm so glad you said that. Yes, because that was going to be my point. You know, my biggest problem with that particular type of lifestyle is that you don't learn how to go and do it on your own. You're kind of subject to having to return back to them to figure out how many points you're getting, or even ordering the meals that they pre-prepare for you. Counting points, counting calories, all of those things, I like to veer people away from, because it doesn't have to be that difficult or that specific. Maybe at first, you know, when I tell people to log their food so we can get a good idea of what you're doing, but I don't want to tell you that you're going to have to do that forever. I don't think that anybody should have to do that forever. So I do have a little problem with that aspect. But I do know that a lot of people have success because they start out on that type of program and it works for them, for the simple reason, I think, because they are, or my, in theory, is because they're paying attention to what they're eating. It's not that you're counting the points necessarily. It's not that you're eating their food. It's that you're following the guidelines and the principles of that lifestyle. And once you veer away from that, like you said, you know, you go back to your old habits. They're not teaching you new habits along the way and how to incorporate that into your current lifestyle.
Right. And there are some positive aspects of Weight Watchers. It does have a tendency to cause you to eat less, which ultimately does lead to some weight loss. It doesn't necessarily stress fat loss friendly exercise. It basically stresses caloric focused exercise. The things I like about it would be, number one, they do have a support component to it and an accountability component to it. And I think the people who do the best are the people who take advantage of the accountability aspects built into the Weight Watchers program. So that's a plus. Yes. I think that the fact that it is generally going to help control carb intake, because oftentimes, and they have various programs as I understand it, some that are a little bit more low carb, a little bit more low glycemic compared to others. So I do like that there is a customization component to it. I just really can't get past the fact that, number one, it does kind of require you to keep logging for the rest of your life. It does have a tendency to force you back into the purchase of their bars or their foods, you know, or foods that have their point system on it.
Because it makes it simple. And I appreciate that they do that for people, because for some, that makes it really easy. That makes it doable.
Right.
I don't think the point system is a horrible idea. I just don't know that you want to do that for the rest of your life.
Now, that may not be the case for everybody who's listening. Some of you guys are listening and you've had wondrous success with Weight Watchers, and it fits the culture of your life as well. Like, you are a logger. You love to log things. And if that's you, then that's you. Don't let us talk you out of that. Just because, you know, it may not be appropriate for everybody or for even the majority of the population. If it's right for you, then it's right. Okay?
Right. Yep, I agree.
Let's get into some of the other ones. The volumetrics is number two on the list. And I actually like this approach better, because it's a principle-based approach to eating, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. It's a high volume of low-calorie foods. So basically eating loads of veggies, loads of fibrous foods, natural foods. I like this. I think we could all add a little volumetrics in our life.
Yeah, so they focus on calorie density with volumetrics, right? So calorie density, if you recall from previous episodes, or you probably have read about it, involves foods that are very, you know, bulky in the sense that there's a lot of food on a plate, but low calorie in the sense that the density of the energy in that food is very low.
Is low, right. So you could eat 4 cups of kale in a salad and feel full, and you don't really get that many calories, but you get plenty of fiber. It's filling, it's a satiating type of way of eating. And in my opinion, it's extremely healthy if you're somebody who finds yourself not being able to get in enough fruits and vegetables.
Right. A good example is having a snack size Snickers on one side and a big bowl of vegetables of equal calories on the other. That's volumetrics. Right.
And that's going to be a big old bowl.
Yes, exactly. So we do okay. like that. Yep. And the next one is the
flexitarian diet. And I actually had to go in and read a few pages of this book that's out. And I can't remember the name of the author, but she's written this book. And it's basically vegetarian-ish is what one of the reviews said. So basically it's for the people who like the idea of going vegan or vegetarian, but they're not completely ready to give up that carnivorous part of their life. So it's we pepper in some meat for those who just can't completely give it up, but we're filling ourselves with plenty of fruits and vegetables and high fiber foods.
Right, it's kind of like grains again. Kind of like eating like an ape in a sense, is that apes are mostly vegetarian and they're considered opportunistic carnivores. So they eat primarily vegetables, nuts, things like that, fruits. But if a lizard happens to scurry by within arm's reach, they may grab it and throw it in their mouths. So it's the kind of thing that what's good about it is it's flexible, which I guess is where flexitarian comes from. What's potentially bad about it is the rails on which your lifestyle is built may not be strong enough for most people who need a few more kind of, you know, focused rules to live by in order to keep their train on the tracks, right?
Yeah, that was kind of the same idea I got from that is, you know, if you don't already eat fairly healthy and you're not even sure what is healthy, you know, it depends on what your idea of eating healthy is. If you're not already eating lean meats, plenty of vegetables, fruits, nuts, whole grains, if you're not already doing that, this would be a little difficult to follow.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, what you want to do is kind of reach into each one of these diet approaches and say, hey, that resonates with me, and take it out and try it on. So that's those are the three that they talked about. They did, again, mention the fact that the Mediterranean diet was considered the best overall diet specifically for health. But it can also be quite beneficial for weight loss as well.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Now, in 2018, CNN suggested that the DASH diet, and DASH is an acronym for Dietary Approaches to Stop Hypertension or High Blood Pressure. It came in second this year with the overall diets, but last year that is what they focused on. And, you know, it's kind of eating healthy for your genetics, eating healthy for your hormones. I think they're kind of the same idea, the DASH diet and the Mediterranean diet. The DASH diet isn't necessarily a cultural lifestyle, though. So the Mediterranean diet has hopped one above that. I think they've just found where the DASH diet probably lives its life the best, which is in the Mediterranean area. And I think that they've just kind of one-upped it by finding the culture who follows this lifestyle on a daily basis.
And I think that word lifestyle is a key word to note, because so let's back up a little bit and say, well, what happened to low carb diets? Have they kind of fallen out of favor? Are they out of vogue now? And the truth is, low carb diets have outperformed low fat diets in practically every study published. So that hasn't changed.
Right.
When we talk about low carbs diet versus the Mediterranean diet, well, what we see, even though the Mediterranean diet isn't necessarily a low-carb diet, what we see is that it performs about as well as low-carb diets as it pertains to weight loss. So what's going on here? Is it not important to be low-carb? Is that what's, you know, is that the message that we have here? And the answer is yes and no, okay? It depends, right? It depends.
Yeah. So, I was going to say yes and no.
It depends. So,
I think it depends on the types of carbohydrates that you're eating. I mean, I know it depends on the type of carbohydrates that you're eating. And if you're eating foods that are primarily natural foods, naturally occurring foods, like lots of vegetables, whole wheat pastas, because I know that, you know, Mediterranean area is like Italy, Greece, France. You know, you think about these areas, and when I saw Italy, I was like, well, yeah, pasta. So whole grain pastas, naturally made pastas, not ones that are, you know, processed and put in a box to mix with powdered orange cheese. You know, not those type of of pasta. So I think it's the source of the food that is most important here.
Right. And there's a lot that goes into the Mediterranean lifestyle. And I want to jump back to that idea, because we always talk about the diet and we fail to make mention of the fact that there is a whole culture built around that diet that also comes into play. For example, they stress less than generally we do in the in America and Australia and places where we start to see a lot more of these type weight issues develop. And they move a lot more. They get around it, and activity is just part of the lifestyle.
Yeah.
And that also comes into play. So less stress, you know, more more activity. When they do sit down to eat, they're eating mindfully. They're not just like walking around, you know, throwing bags of chips into their mouths. They're sitting down with friends and family. They, you know, they're shutting down the businesses, and they're actually spending time to actually taste and enjoy the food and the people that they're with. And that does have an impact on how your body metabolizes and utilizes that food.
Absolutely. And, you know, I find myself teetering between this as well, you know, with kids and family and work and doing all these things. We tend to do, Americans especially, tend to do a lot of eating on the run and rushing to the next place and really not paying attention to what we're eating, which robs us of having that satiety, that feeling of, wow, I just ate a huge meal. Yes, it was in my car. Yes, it was on the go, but we're not feeling like we just ate a meal, you know, and then you sit down and you're stressed out, and it's just not a good place to be. So focusing on a more active lifestyle is definitely where it's at. If you're trying, you know, if you find yourself eating healthy, but not mindfully eating, focusing on taking the time to sit down and relax and pay attention to what you're doing, because multitasking while you're eating just is proving not to work for us.
Right. And this is a good segue into the Japanese diet, which is similar to the Mediterranean diet in that it can perform similarly to low-carb eating when it's done right. So what's interesting about this diet, about the Japanese approach to eating, is that it's very much built into the culture of their society. And there is this kind of, there's good and there's bad to this, okay? There's good in a sense because they do have a tendency to build discipline around eating into the lifestyle, into the culture of their society. One good example is the fact that there is a, I want to say a principle, but a...
like a cultural rule.
Yeah, and that is they eat until 80% full. Okay. And they don't discriminate between carbs, fats, or proteins. They don't really give proteins and carbs any mind. In fact, what they noted, what the research has suggested, is that they do, in fact, eat approximately 25% fewer calories in their daily eating than Americans do. And it may have a lot to do with this cultural rule of, you know what, when you eat, you don't eat until you're about to explode.
Until you're stuffed, right.
Have you ever looked over at a friend after eating out at a restaurant and said, you're going to have to roll me out of this restaurant?
I can't believe you just asked me that, because I cannot tell a lie. Yes, it was recently. It was sushi. And so it was Japanese food.
But how
it was
about
sushi.
That?
It was so delicious. And I looked at the last three pieces on my plate. This is just like last Friday. I looked at the last three pieces on my plate, looked over at my husband, and I was like, I'm too full. I can't eat that. And he's like, well, I'm full. I'm not going to eat it. And I was like, okay, fine. Twist my arm. And I ate the last three pieces. And I was like, okay, you know what? Then I was uncomfortable. Then it wasn't fun anymore. So taste versus, you know, satiety. I should have chosen satiety.
Hey, you know, you can't win every battle you fight, but you do win the war. That's the ultimate goal, you know? And
yes.
So the Japanese, you know, they also have a stigma around people who are overweight, and that can even take it to a higher level, and this is the bad part of it, to a higher level than what we see in America. And so that pressure does cause people to stick to their kind of disciplined lifestyle. And so that's one of the potential downsides of it. I will also say the Japanese also have social norms that discourage mindless eating practices, like eating on the run, eating while distracted, like watching TV is not a thing that they would do, eating in schools while walking, etc. So these are all factors that speak to the mindless component of how we as Americans have a tendency to eat, and in other cultures where weight is becoming a bigger and bigger problem.
Interesting. I like that instilling that in our youth become a priority because, you know, you said eating a bag of chips while walking through the hall. I mean, that's like every high school student I can think of.
Absolutely. And the Japanese have a tendency to eat three meals with minimal snacking in between the meals. And this likely decreases the total caloric intake during the day. It also helps to regulate insulin because, you know, in past podcasts, we've talked about how you can regulate how much insulin your body produces in a day by eating fewer carbs at meals, but also by eating fewer meals throughout the day, right? Where you see a spike in insulin every time you eat. If you eat fewer meals, you don't get those two extra spikes or three extra spikes throughout the day. So that, too, may be one area why they are much more you know, their weight is a lot healthier than it is in other cultures.
Good point. Yeah, all the mindless snacking that we do is definitely taking a toll here.
Go on.
Oh, I was going to say, and I know that, you know, if I picture Japan, which I've only been to twice, everyone walks everywhere. People are physically active. There are, they labor more. You know, there are jobs, they're outside working. You know, they might not exercise like at a gym as much. I'm not 100% sure about that, but I don't, when I picture their culture, I don't see people at the gym feverishly trying to work off calories. I see people walking, moving, laboring, being outside, being active.
Right. It speaks a lot that one of the most popular, you know, holiday gifts is a hoverboard here in America.
Yes. You
know, which is basically a two-wheeled machine that allows you to expend as little energy as possible getting from A to B. And in cultures like the Mediterranean and in Japan, then walking, cycling, moving is built into the lifestyle, and it's looked down upon or frowned upon to be somebody who doesn't move around and expend those calories.
Yes. So the next little thing I wanted to kind of touch on was, okay, so if you think about a Japanese diet, you think of a bowl of rice, probably some fish or some sort of protein, lots of vegetables. What do you find is the difference between our type of low carb dieting or our type of generalized eating, if you're paying attention to your carbohydrates, versus the Japanese style of eating? So, because there are some similarities between low carb dieting here and Japanese style eating.
Right. So, you know, to me, there are a few factors that come into play. Number one, when you rip the diet out of the culture and we look at just the diet under a microscope, there's nothing too mind-blowing about the Japanese diet, in a sense, because it is rice heavy, right? There's a lot of rice built into it. There's stir fry, you know, lots of vegetables, lots of, there's, you know, the drinks that they drink at dinner is not big vats of soda, you know, and green tea, which does have a positive impact on metabolism and other things within the body. So you can't necessarily just rip the diet out and investigate the diet and say the diet's the reason why this culture doesn't have a problem with weight. You've got to also look at the activity. You've got to look at the habits of discipline and practice of physical, you know, practice that they have in their daily lives. You've got to look at a lot of factors in order to figure out, well, you know, what's the difference? Because yeah, when you rip the diet out and you look at it, we look at carbs. Hey, it's fairly high percentage carbs. You look at protein, it's not excessively high in protein. The vegetables, yeah, there's a lot of vegetables in the diet, but not huge quantities, you know, like, in my restaurant, we serve salads that are 3 to 5 servings of vegetables in one salad for one person. And and it just may be a single serving of vegetables. And so it may not be the volume of vegetables that they're consuming in their culture. It's everything, right? It's everything.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, good point.
And, you know, what about this? You know, because what basically is people may be listening and saying, well, this just sounds like a low-calorie approach to living. And the answer is yes, but practically all diets that are successful are generally lower calorie diets. Even the low carb diet, you know, if we look at the low carb diet, when we look at why it's effective, it has a tendency to be because people who eat low carb diets have a tendency to eat less, partially because blood sugar and insulin stabilize, but partially also because food doesn't taste as good. And they're not as motivated to seek it out because it doesn't give them the high that they get from eating high starch, high sugar foods, right?
Right. Yeah. And, you know, a point I think we need to make is low carb diets have outperformed all of the low fat diets in just about every single study. So when I think about Japanese food, I think about low fat because if they don't eat a lot of things that contain high fat. You know, you don't see fried chicken in a food truck when you're walking down the street. Mm-hmm. You don't see cheese on top of all of their meals. Like very rarely, I think, would we see those types of things. But so it's not necessarily just the amount of fats or carbs that you're getting. It's the overall lifestyle, and it's the continuous lifestyle. I think when you eat like that for a certain length of time, for a long time, if that is built into your culture, your body is going to reflect those more positive choices when it comes to food.
Right. And you know, one of the issues with here in America or in other countries like America where you know, we eat large quantities of food is if we go with the mentality, okay, I'm going to cut the fat down to match that of a Japanese culture.
Uh-huh.
What ends up happening is you end up actually eating more overall because you are not satiated by the food that you're eating. But because in Japan, they have such discipline around food built into their culture that they don't eat past that 80% full situation, they don't run into the same issue. Whereas in America, when people are hungry, they have a tendency to eat. I was reading an article and they said, you know, that it said that we're not addicted to food in America. We're addicted to eating.
Ah,
if yes. You digest that for a second, it's kind of an epiphany light bulb moment, right?
Yeah, definitely a mindset. You know, if you're mindfully eating, let's just say you and I go to Japan for a week and we hang out. You know, I'm sure that we would find plenty of activities to do. We would eat the food that was available to us, and we would be satiated. And I think just the mere fact of being surrounded by that puts you in a different mindset. Doing that while you're living here in America, it might be something that you wrestle with a little bit. You know, it, just the whole feeling satiated and eating and not having everyone around you doing the same thing, you know, eating mindfully and feeling like you don't need to go out and eat a piece of fried chicken or a bag of chips or something. If it's not something that you're surrounded by, it's a lot easier to kind of get out of that mindset. Right. But I totally, that is totally an epiphany. We're addicted to the eating, not the food. Interesting. Yeah.
So, you know, does this apply to us? Does this Japanese approach of eating till 80% full apply to us here in America? Well, a Penn State study suggests that it does. When they served women 25% less food than their normal eating, and that ultimately translated to about 30% fewer calories. So you got to look at the food, how much food you're eating. So 25% less food resulting in 30% fewer calories without worrying themselves about carbs, protein, or fat.
Okay.
The women ultimately started consuming 800 fewer calories per day. And here's the most important part. They weren't missing the food. They weren't hungry.
Wow. 800 calories less. That's crazy how that adds up.
Right. Right, it is.
That's amazing.
So one thing we can do is consider eating from smaller plates, because when we are given larger portions, we have a tendency to eat 45% more calories.
Hence my sushi story.
Hence the sushi story. That's right.
Yeah. So the Mediterranean diet is not something that I would classify as a quote-unquote diet. And I try to veer away from the word diet. It's not my favorite thing. Lifestyle is what I like to call it. It's something that you can continue with. And, you know, to sum it up, people in the Mediterranean cultures eat less food. They eat smaller portions. They consume more whole foods, like I was talking about, more naturally occurring foods. And they eat mindfully. It's not a low-carb diet, not a low-calorie density diet. It's a high nutrient density diet, which leaves you feeling like you've had enough.
Right. And again, people may be thinking, okay, well, oh, that's not groundbreaking stuff, right? Okay. Eat less, move more is what it sounds like. But let me kind of take it a notch up, because we are talking about a totally different culture. And so a lot of these things that you see in the Japanese and the Mediterranean lifestyle may not necessarily have the same benefit. Plus, a lot of us are starting from this from different points, right?
Right.
So I will say this, that there is it's a whole different animal to eat in a way to prevent weight gain than it is to eat in a way to lose weight.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different animal because metabolically we change. And let me see if I can make sense of this in an example. If I were to have a person who was 250 pounds and lost 50 pounds, so now they're 200 pounds, and they're eating lunch at a cafe with a friend who is just 200 pounds and have been their whole life. Mm-hmm. They order the same food. They eat the same amount on the plate. The person who lost the 50 pounds is actually burning about 20% fewer calories than the other person who's just eating the same meal, but has never really tried to lose weight. They just hang out in their set point at 200 pounds. So there is a consequence metabolically to losing weight that we don't see in people who are eating just to maintain their set point.
Right, which is why when I speak to clients or people who have joined our Cut the Fat Podcast Challenge, you know, what is your history? Are you a chronic yo-yo dieter? Where have you been? I don't need to know your weight today. I need to know what has led us up to where you are today. And it's because of what you just said. You know, we don't all operate the same. We all have different starting points. We all have different paths. And it's so important to let that really sink in, because if, let's just say Jane at the gym, say I follow her around. I'm basically her shadow. I do everything she does. She's recently just lost 50 pounds. I do everything she does. I eat the exact same way she does. I'm following this person like a shadow. I am not going to get the same results as Jane. It just is because we all fall into different categories based on our history when it comes to weight loss or maintenance or muscle building. All of these things are part of that formula.
So I have a theory, which I call staged weight loss theory. Mm-hmm. And this basically speaks to the fact that as the body weight shifts downward, the tools and the strategies needed to continue to lose weight shift as well. That you can't do what you do in the beginning of a weight loss program, let's say if you have 100 pounds to lose, as you can in the middle or towards the end. And so what I try to do is break it down into four main metabolic stages, which we call the sweatpants. This model is called the sweatpants to swimsuit model. It's the sweatpants stage is where people, you know, generally
bikini
start.
Model.
Right. I say the sweatpants to swimsuit only because most people are going to be very happy just getting to the swimsuit stage.
Okay.
And most people, you know, would not necessarily need to do what needs to be done or would be willing to do what needs to be done to go into that last final stage. But I call it the sweatpants a swimsuit model because the bikini is technically a swimsuit too. But anyway,
okay.
It's not perfect. So sweatpants and the bikini stage, which are the bookends of the model, are caloric stages, and I'll explain that here in a second. The skinny jeans and the swimsuit stage, which are the two middle stages, are actually hormonal stages. So when we have this discussion about what's more important, calories or hormones, the answer is yes, it depends on where you fall on this model.
When you have for everyone that is in our challenge or has been in one of our challenges, you're familiar with these stages because it's easy to kind of go through and classify yourself as a basic starting point. And this really just kind of helps you build the foundation, figuring out where you're at and where you need to go from here.
Yes. And that's what I love about it is, you know, within the challenge, we have these stages, and then within each stage, we have three sub-stages so that people can say, okay, I'm here. This is where I'm at. And mm-hmm. these are the habits that I'm going to instill for this particular stage because this is what's effective. So when you have a lot of weight to lose, especially Basically, what stage you're in is the sweatpants stage. So let's say you haven't really been dieting, you haven't really been doing anything. You've just been basically eating what you want, and you've gained, let's say, 50 pounds.
Okay.
The fat cells at that point, because you're at your heaviest weight at this point, are overstuffed, and the body changes very quickly when it's in a kind of emergency state like that. That mm-hmm. excess fat, it's not just excess fat, it's over excess fat, right? It basically is forcing the body into an inflammatory state. The body wants out of that inflammatory state. So when we make relatively small changes like eating to 80% full, whereas we would normally eat to 100% or 110% full.
Mm-hmm.
Adding a little more activity. Right, like going for a walk, right?
Yeah.
We may see some change. We may see some weight loss at that point, and we may think, well, this is easy, right? We call that the easy fat. We're dealing with the easy fat.
Mm-hmm.
But then what happens, Blythe?
Well, then we realize that what we're doing isn't working anymore, and you have to figure out where you're at. So the fat release happens faster than the fat burn.
Right.
So
when you're in the first stage, the sweatpants stage, basically you're able to release fat into the blood from the fat cells, and faster than you are able to burn the fat.
Right. To dip into your fat stores and burn that. Right.
Right. And then as you move into the skinny jean stage, as you said,
you've got to cut out some calories and move a little more. You've got to keep upping the bar, because if you don't, our bodies are great adapting machines. And if you incorporate something new, see great change as you do in the sweatpants stage, eventually at some point that small level that you have raised up to, your body is going to adapt. So you've got to up the bar a little bit more. So cutting calories, moving more, becoming a little more active, maybe starting some sort of an exercise program if you haven't done anything up till now. The minimal things like walking and cutting a few calories just aren't going to work anymore. It's time to get in to the hormones,
right,
to increase our ability to release fat. And that is what becomes most – and burn it. And that's what becomes most important in the skinny jean stage. We've reached a hormonal part of the weight loss journey.
Right. So, you know, in the sweatpants stage, it was really about calories. We were just eating and consuming too many calories. When we start to cut that back, great, we start to see some weight loss. And then we hit a wall. That's when we move from the easy fat into the stubborn fat. And when you're in the stubborn fat stage, basically it becomes a hormonally sensitive stage. So now this is when things like high intensity interval training really comes into play. Like in the sweatpants stage, you don't need to jump into a high intensity interval training session. You can just walk some more and you'll get some result. But once you hit into the skinny jeans and the swimsuit stages, then you've got to really up the ante, because now the problem isn't with the ability to burn the fat that's present. The problem is that the bottleneck is in the ability to release the fat into the blood. So we can burn it faster than we can release it. And so when we start to do high intensity interval training, what does that do to the fat cells? Well, it opens them up so that you can start releasing some of that stubborn fat that's locked up in there. And
right.
And
same thing with resistance training. You know, you're working hard and getting yourself into a resistance training program will do the same thing. It helps balance those hormones. And that's where you are when you reach that skinny jean stage. It's really time to get in. I think a lot of people get hung up on biting off more than we can chew. So if you're in that sweatpants stage and your fat cells are just overstuffed and you jump in 110%, you know, I feel like people get worn out beginning a program that way. And it becomes hard to continue, too hard to continue. So if you can take it by stages, I think this is really where one of the secrets lie.
Right. And the problem is this, you know, when you're in the sweatpants stage and you are let's say you jump into high intensity interval training. Well, what does high intensity interval training do? It does increase your daily metabolic burn, but more than that, it floods the body with adrenaline. And what does adrenaline do? It releases fat from the fat cells. So you already are good at releasing fat into the blood. So you might be thinking, well, if I release more fat, that's good for me, right? And the answer is no, it's not. Not if you're already releasing plenty of fat into the blood, because what happens is you end up backing up the system and you end up clogging up the system. This is why people who lose weight too aggressively in the beginning stages end up with a fatty liver, more insulin resistance, because all that fat is basically clogging up the insulin receptors of the muscles in the liver. And they end up with fluctuations in blood sugar that make it almost impossible to continue to lose weight. Their cravings and their hunger go through the roof. They seem to get sicker than they were before they started the weight loss program.
Right. So, and ding, ding, ding. That is a huge gold nugget. For those of you out there who, you know, start a brand new plan and you jump in at 300%, you're like, I'm doing this come hell or high water. I'm working out for 3 hours a day, every day. And you're in the sweatpants stage. This is why it doesn't work.
It's actually healthier for you to slow things down a little bit.
Yeah.
And do more activity that doesn't necessarily cause you to open up the fat cells, open up the dams, if you will, and flood the blood with fat. You wanna because your cells are already good at releasing fat, don't do a lot of things necessarily that cause that to happen at a much more aggressive rate. Instead, slow things down a little bit. Let your body's metabolism acclimate to things. You know, release a little, burn a little. Release a little, burn a little. So you might, you know, you might cut the calories, which does what? It causes the body to start releasing that fat into the blood, and then you walk. And that walking enhances the caloric burn, nudges it up some without necessarily flooding the blood with adrenaline, and you burn that fat that's being released from the fat cells. So that's the balance. And then we get into a lot of this in the swimsuit and bikini stages, which, you know, generally are exaggerated. You know, we just require more hormonal stimulus in the swimsuit stage. Mm-hmm. And then guess what happens? We regress back into the caloric stage when we want to go from swimsuit to bikini, right? Isn't that what bodybuilders have a tendency to do? They get really focused in on managing calories at that point.
Yeah, losing those last few percents of body fat when you're getting ready to go on stage. You know, you probably got between 2 and 6 weeks of really paying attention and dialing in on your macronutrients, your caloric intake, timing your exercise with your meals, just so you hit, you know, when your insulin levels are coming down about 9 minutes after a meal, that's when you want to exercise. So it's all about timing when you get down to that bikini stage. And guys, slow and steady wins the race. I know it sounds cliche, but it's true. When it comes to weight loss and doing it the right way, doing it the way it's going to last you forever, slow and steady wins the race.
Sure as heck does. Mm-hmm. Okay, great. So I know that we went through a lot in today's podcast, but here's the good news. We have a new thing on our website, which is called the Cut the Fat Fan Club. Mm-hmm. And it's totally free. You just go to cutthefatpodcast.com. You'll see a link there on the front page. Put in your name and email address. The system will automatically send you a username and password. You log in, and in that section, you're going to find the cheat sheet for this episode, which will basically break down the topic into 25 to 30 golden nugget points. So it just makes it a lot easier to go back and review the information that we go through in each of these podcasts.
Right. And it's like Cliff Notes.
Right.
Almost like Cliff Notes. Don't feel like you can't listen to this podcast again, because you're absolutely welcome to. But those Cliff Notes definitely help. So I would advise everyone to log into cutthefatpodcast.com and look at our little cheat sheet from today's podcast. So should we summarize this?
Yeah, let's go ahead.
Okay. So summary point number one. Sometimes it's really as simple as eating like 20% less food while increasing the nutrient density of the food that you are eating. So instead of having a cupcake, have one of my sweet potato muffins. And as you lose weight, you need to increase the intensity of your lifestyle.
Good. Right. For point number one. The intensity meaning basically as you lose weight, it becomes less about the slow and the steady, you know, decrease in calories, and more about the abrupt increase in hormones followed by, you know, activity to burn. So the intensity of things increase and escalates as you kind of move through the model. Okay.
Next. Right. The type of exercise that you're doing. Summary point number two, eat mindfully when you do eat. And I think this is something we can all work on. Stop eating on the run and start moving more in general outside of exercise. So basically becoming more active. You know, go for a walk. Take your dog an extra block next time you take your dog for a walk. Go to the park with your kids and you go down the slide a couple of times with them or hop on the swing with them. You know, just little bouts of activity add up.
Cool. Yep.
Number three, as you lose weight, you are going to burn fewer calories like we talked about. The guys eating lunch together that order the same meal, one has been 200 pounds for his entire life. Entire adult life. And the other one has recently lost 50 pounds and is now also 200 pounds. As you lose weight, you are likely to burn fewer calories. To recover your metabolism, you have to focus on building and maintaining muscle mass, because muscle mass is what constitutes the speed of your metabolism. This is why exercise and activity changes and becomes more intense as we lose.
Yeah, I was watching a documentary on HBO about this phenomenon of how we start burning fewer calories as we lose weight. And they came to the conclusion, they said, it may never recover for you. And I'm like, no, you can recover it, but it's going to take hard work to build the muscle mass to the point where you're now burning calories that are appropriate for somebody of your age and weight. The problem is if you just lose weight and you don't do something to recover that metabolism, then yes, right, there does seem to be a lasting mark on the metabolism from losing weight that does not recover without some sort of active movement in favor of a strong metabolism.
Right. It's never too late to be in the best shape of your life. I tell people that every single day. It's never too late. As you lose weight, so number four, as you lose weight, focus on shifting the hormones in such a way that promotes more fat release, like we just talked about. High intensity interval training, walking, even incorporating something like intermittent fasting. You know, that's something that we've done a podcast on before. Intermittent fasting is something that can kind of help reignite some of those hormones to get your body more balanced so you can access those fat stores.
And we'll do more on that this coming year on the podcast as well, get a little bit deeper into intermittent fasting.
Yeah, we found great success with that. I'm really excited about talking about that some more.
Good.
Summary point number five, never use cookie cutter diets and lifestyle. If something works for you, and our last podcast, episode 103, we totally talked about this. If something works for you, keep it in your toolbox. Keep it in your arsenal. If it doesn't work, you can toss it out. You don't have to follow any particular diet 100% to have it work or not work. Life doesn't operate that way. You take the golden nuggets, the things that resonate with you, and you keep them and utilize them. If you go to, you know, never ditch your plan is what I'm trying to say. If you've found things that work for you, keep them in your pocket.
Also remember, though, that as things shift for your metabolism, some of those tools that didn't work in the past may start working, right? Like we talked about how you know, calorie counting may work in the sweatpants stage, but it loses its effect in the skinny jeans and swimsuit stage. But when you jump back into the bikini stage, then calorie counting becomes a tool that's now usable again, because the body kind of shifts. You're kind of shifting back into that mentality of tweaking the program, and to tweak to that level, to move from swimsuit to bikini stage,
you need to
requires that level of dialing in. Correct.
Yeah, absolutely. Awesome. I think that was a great podcast today. Tons of golden nuggets.
All right. Great, guys. You know where to find us, cutthefatpodcast.com. Please review the podcast if you can. If you're downloading it for the first time, hop on iTunes, Spreaker, where, you know, if you're an Android person listening online and you just don't know where to go, you can go to, I believe, Spreaker and Spotify and Stitcher. All those places now have the podcast. And tell all your family and friends.
We love our Cut the Fat podcast listeners. Thank you guys so much for tuning in. Have a fantastic day.
Now get to work. We'll see you next time.
That's right. Bye.